An attack on Israel by Iran or its proxies looms.
We share the same concerns and expectations that our Israeli counterparts have with respect to potential timing here. Could be this week. We're continuing to watch it very, very closely.
Ukraine makes gains in the Kursk region.
Ukraine's top commander said on Monday that Kyiv controlled around 1,000 square kilometers of Russia's Kursk region 7 days after the incursion began.
And there are dogs that sniff for drugs, guns, and even money. South Korea is using a dog that sniffs for bed bugs.
He's the first and so far only canine trained in the country to detect the odor of pheromones, the chemicals released by bed bugs.
Today is Tuesday, August 13th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Alexis Strobe. Tensions in the Middle East are reaching a tipping point as Iran or its proxies remain poised to attack Israel following the assassination of Hamas political leader Ismail Haniyeh in Tehran and a senior Hezbollah commander in Beirut. White House National Security spokesman John Kirby says the attack could happen soon.
We share the same concerns and expectations that our Israeli counterparts have with respect to potential timing here. Could be this week. We're continuing to watch it very, very closely.
Kirby also said it's not clear what the attack could look like.
It is difficult to ascertain at this particular time if there is an attack by Iran and or its proxies, what that could look like. But we have to be prepared for what could be a significant set of attacks.
Since Iran and its proxies have threatened to attack Israel, the U.S. has displayed a sense of urgency in beefing up its military presence in the region. U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin has ordered a guided missile submarine to the Middle East and is telling the USS Abraham Lincoln Aircraft Carrier Strike Group to sail more quickly to the area. Meanwhile, several world leaders are also doing what they can to help prevent a wider Middle East conflict. French President Emmanuel Macron, German Chancellor Olaf Scholz, and British Prime Minister Keir Starmer in a joint statement have endorsed the latest push by mediators, United States, Qatar, and Egypt to broker an agreement to end the 10-month Israel-Hamas war. Ceasefire talks are scheduled for Thursday. For more on the latest developments, VOA's Lori London spoke with Linda Granstein in Jerusalem.
Are there also concerns there that there could be a wider regional war, that this wouldn't be just some strike in retaliation, just sort of a symbolic, or are there more concerns of something bigger this time?
No, there are definitely concerns of something bigger, and both Iran and Hezbollah have said that they're planning something much bigger. In April, for the first time, Iran directly attacked Israel, something like 300 rockets and missiles, almost all of which were shot down by both Israel and the United States, the Jordanians. But now they're sort of expecting something much larger. The idea is that, you know, Hezbollah has said and Iran has said and Israel, nobody wants a war, but it's possible that it could easily kind of turn into that. Israel's also considering a preemptive strike on Hezbollah.
And we have potentially renewed ceasefire hostage release talks coming up this Thursday amid all of this. Do you feel like the tensions and the threat of an attack is going to push that forward? Or are people feeling skeptical that anything can really come out of it at this point?
Well, these are being called sort of last ditch talks that, you know, if they don't get an agreement soon, there won't be an agreement. But again, that's a lot of posturing. Originally, I think the thought was that Iran would hold off until after these talks to see if anything was going to come out of it. And that, for some reason, has changed in the last 24 hours. But I think the two really aren't all that connected. There is a deal on the table. It's the deal that President Biden has been talking about that he says is an Israeli proposal. The Israeli press reports say that what has changed is that the new leader of Hamas, I mean, he was always the leader of the military wing. He's now the leader of the political wing as well. Yahya Sinwar, who's believed to be hiding in a tunnel underground in Gaza somewhere, that he wants a deal, that there's a sense that, you know, he will get a better deal now than perhaps he could have gotten before, and that, you know, the population in Gaza, with a growing humanitarian crisis, with the number of deaths approaching 40,000, he's concerned they could turn on Hamas, so that he wants a deal. The question is whether Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu wants a deal. And in the last couple of weeks, we've had reports from various generals is saying that Netanyahu is the one who's holding out the deal.
And I know there's a lot of consternation in that regard with the hostage families in particular. Would you say that there's a major division going on between not only the Israeli government, the Netanyahu government, and also the citizens who want these people brought home?
I think there is a growing sense that Netanyahu is making decisions based on his own political situation rather than what really is best for the country. Now, some people and Netanyahu's supporters say that it is the military pressure that has led Hamas to soften its stand, and that Hamas has now agreed, for example, that Israel doesn't have to agree to end the war, that there will be a 6-week ceasefire. Something like 30 hostages will be released, mostly humanitarian cases. And then during that 6 weeks, they will negotiate a longer ceasefire. But at the same time, there does seem to be that Netanyahu is imposing new conditions each time. And the right wing of his government has said that if he agrees to a hostage deal, they might pull out of the government, bringing down the government and causing new elections. So there definitely is a growing rift, you know, and it's coming after 10 months of war when Israelis were very united and very much in favor of the war. And, you know, more than 300,000 soldiers were called up for reserve duty. Now, some of those soldiers are on their second or third rounds of reserve duty. They have families, they have businesses. So there's a sense, I think, that Israelis want the hostages home, they want the war to end, and they just sort of want to move forward.
That was Lori London speaking with Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem. Ukraine's top military commander says his forces now control 1,000 square kilometers of Russia's neighboring Kursk region. His statement marked the first time a Ukrainian military official has publicly commented on the gains of the incursion. General Alexander Sirsky made the comment in a video posted Monday to Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky's Telegram channel. Russian President Vladimir Putin said on Monday that Ukraine was trying to undermine Russian stability with its incursion into the south of the country, but it would not succeed. Ukraine's advance into Russian territory is not without risk, an analyst told Reuters on Monday. Dr. Marion Mesmer from the think tank Chatham House explains the likely strategy behind Ukraine's move. Here is Reuters correspondent Jillian Kitchener.
Ukraine's surprise cross-border incursion marked a significant shift in the almost 2.5-year war with Russia. It was Kyiv's biggest attack on Russian territory since Moscow invaded Ukraine in February 2022. International security expert Dr. Marion Mesmer of the London-based think tank Chatham House told Reuters there are a couple likely strategies at play.
My best guess is that Ukraine, you know, on the one hand, wanted to push back against Russia, perhaps to increase any leverage that they might have in any upcoming negotiations. It also seems to have been an attempt to draw Russian military attention away from where they were pushing ahead. And that seems to have worked pretty well.
Ukraine had been losing territory to Russian forces until its surprise attack. Mesmer says it's a risky move.
One risk, of course, is that we've already seen that Russia has much more military personnel than Ukraine. And while Ukraine has managed to kind of stretch Russian military forces thinner, it also has to stretch its own forces much thinner. And Russia presumably is going to try and hit back quite hard because this is obviously making them look quite bad. And it's something that Putin won't want to see repeated. So this could lead to quite significant losses for the Ukrainian military, which are much harder for Ukraine to absorb than for Russia, which doesn't necessarily have the same personnel challenge.
Mesmer said that Ukraine's counteroffensive has likely lifted its soldiers' spirits, at least for the time being.
I think the counteroffensive so far has done a lot for morale. I mean, Ukrainians know that the alternative to the war, if it was to end badly for them, isn't good. And so that is part of why they have been so committed and so behind the government. And I think this very successful counteroffensive has meant that there is a real sense that, you know, Ukraine could win the war, but it could, of course, also sort of go in the other direction if Russian attacks intensify as a result.
Ukraine's top commander said on Monday that Kyiv controlled around 1,000 square kilometers of Russia's Kursk region 7 days after the incursion began.
That was Reuters correspondent Jillian Kitchener. We're following these other stories from around the world. The death toll from a mountain of rubbish that collapsed in the Ugandan capital rose to 24 on Monday as rescuers with excavators continued searching for victims, according to the city authority. Police told reporters at least 4 children are among those killed by the collapse at the Katizi landfill Friday. The collapse is believed to have been triggered by heavy rainfall. The precise details of what happened were unclear, but the city authority said there was a, quote, structural failure in waste mass. British energy firm Drax Global, already facing scrutiny for violating environmental regulations, disclosed this year that its U.S. wood pellet production facilities in Louisiana emit hazardous air pollutants above permitted levels. Drax wood pellet production sites in Louisiana and Mississippi previously paid out millions in pollution-related penalties and settlements, promising to install controls to reduce emissions. Yet these controls did not keep emissions within permitted limits. A new study suggests Mars may be drenched beneath its surface, with enough water hiding in the cracks of underground rocks to form a global ocean. The findings, published Monday, are based on computer modeling as well as seismic measurements from NASA's InSight lander. The spacecraft detected more than 1,300 Mars quakes before shutting down 2 years ago. Scientists say the water is believed to be about 11 to 19 kilometers in the Martian crust. In our continuing coverage of the 2024 U.S. presidential election, immigration is one of the top issues. Vice President Kamala Harris is campaigning on her achievements as a prosecutor, while former President Donald Trump blasts the current administration's record and promises mass deportations of undocumented immigrants. VOA's immigration reporter Aline Barros has more.
On the campaign trail, Vice President Kamala Harris highlights her background as a prosecutor, district attorney, and California Attorney General.
I walked underground tunnels between the United States and Mexico on that border with law enforcement officers. I went after transnational gangs, drug cartels, and human traffickers that came into our country illegally. I prosecuted them. In case after case, and I won.
While in office, former President Donald Trump built more than 50 miles of new border wall, reduced the annual cap on refugee admissions to historic lows, and enforced a policy that separated children from their parents.
This November, the American people are going to compare these records, and they're going to tell Border Czar Harris, "You have done a horrible job. You're a disgrace to our country. You're fired. Get out of here. You're fired. Get out."
Immigration is a hot issue in this presidential election. A Chicago Council survey found that 50% of respondents say a large number of immigrants is a threat to the United States, though just over half of Americans support a border wall and the use of American troops at the U.S.-Mexico border. Most oppose mass deportation of undocumented immigrants. With Congress failing to pass immigration reform, the nation remains dependent on executive actions and regulations, regardless of who is in office.
With the political environment we're in, it's a tough place because executive actions are always going to be the subjects of lawsuits, and we have a Congress that's not willing to act.
Harris pledges to support border security legislation, highlighting Trump's role in sinking a bipartisan Senate bill earlier this year.
He tanked the bipartisan deal because he thought it would help him win an election. Which goes to show Donald Trump does not care about border security. He only cares about himself. So here is my pledge to you. As president, I will bring back the border security bill that Donald Trump killed, and I will sign it into law.
Trump's Republican allies have urged him to focus on areas where they believe he has an advantage over Harris, especially on immigration. He continues to call for the deportation of undocumented migrants and criticizes the Biden-Harris administration for having what he calls an open border policy.
With your vote, inflation will stop. The illegal aliens will be turned back. They're not coming in. We got to stop them. Did you see where she's now saying, oh, we had a very good border. Oh, great. They had the worst border in the history of the world.
The U.S. Border Patrol logged about 130,000 migrant encounters in June, up from about 104,000 in the same month of 2019, Trump's last year before the pandemic, but down from the December 2023 peak of more than 300,000. Alini Barrows, VOA News, Washington.
Greece's worst wildfire this year spread into the Athens suburbs on Monday, forcing hundreds of people to flee as it torched trees, homes, and cars overnight and choked busy roads with smoke and ash. Reuters correspondent Sean Hogan reports.
Just 8 miles from the Athens city center, this is Vrilisia, engulfed in smoke. Fanned by gale force winds, firefighters say flames had reached the deepest into the capital for more than 2 decades. Around 700 firefighters and volunteers, 190 fire engines, and 33 water bombing aircraft have been battling the blaze that broke out on Sunday afternoon, 20 miles north of Athens. France, Italy, and the Czech Republic are expected to assist with aircraft and firefighters. Spain, Cyprus, and Turkey have also offered to help, a Greek government official said. Some residents in the hilly and wooded outer areas of Athens, like Pendali, have stayed to try and protect their own properties.
It hurts. We have grown up in the forest. We feel great sadness and anger.
This man crashed his car as he tried to escape the flames.
I couldn't see. I hit a pine tree, and this is what happened.
Summers in Greece have long been marked by wildfires, but hotter, drier weather linked to climate change have made blazes more frequent and intense. Greece experienced its warmest winter on record and is on track for its hottest ever summer. Large areas of the country have seen little or no rain for months, and temperatures are forecast to reach over 100 degrees Fahrenheit later in the week.
That was Reuters correspondent Sean Hogan. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Alexis Strope. Tom Perriello, the U.S. Special Envoy to Sudan, said on Monday that talks to end Sudan's 16-month war between the Sudanese army and the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces will move forward this week, despite little sign that either party is seeking a peaceful resolution.
We have had a commitment and engagement from the RSF. We've had extensive engagement with the SAF, but they have not yet given us an affirmation, which would be necessary today for moving forward with seating them on the 14th.
Perriello indicated the White House was pushing for the talks to move forward.
It was very clear from the White House and Secretary Blinken that we could not continue to delay these talks and that the trajectory of those delays were not to the benefit of the Sudanese people. Quite frankly, I don't think they were to the benefit of SAF either, but I will leave that to their judgment.
Failure of efforts to bring the war to an end would exacerbate a conflict that has created the world's largest humanitarian crisis, pushing 10 million people out of their homes and creating famine-like conditions across the country. A year ago this month, a massive mob attacked Christians in the Pakistani city of Jaranwala. Crowds of angry Muslims, enraged by reports of alleged blasphemy, burned several churches and homes. VOA Pakistan Bureau Chief Sarah Zaman visits the city as it approaches the anniversary of the violence that shocked the nation.
The bright interior of St. Paul Catholic Church in Jaranwala's Christian town neighborhood hides signs of a horrifying mob attack. On August 16 last year, Muslim mobs, enraged by reports that local Christians had allegedly desecrated a Quran, went on a rampage. They destroyed about 24 churches and looted and damaged several Christian homes across this densely populated city in Pakistan's Punjab province. St. Paul priest Yaqub Yusuf says the desecration and destruction of the church was a huge tragedy, but the Christian community repaired it in a year. The government provided ceiling and wall panels and fans, etc. to restore the church, but Christians are doing the actual building work now. Sajid Masih's residence from across the church was one of many destroyed that day. A year later, his home is livable again. Thank the Lord, we're in better shape, he says, adding that a lot of the repair work is done, but much still remains. With government funds, supports from Muslim charities, and help from Christians in Pakistan and abroad, the restoration of churches and homes continues, though many are unhappy with the pace. The scale of the violence here was shocking. Condemnation came from the highest offices of the state. Still, Pakistan has witnessed more incidents of mob violence over alleged blasphemy. Peter Jacob is the executive director of the Lahore-based Center for Social Justice. He says when the state has a weak narrative, it emboldens people. And when the state negotiates with those involved in acts of terror and extremism in the name of religion, they become powerful and the state becomes weak. It's like holding everyone hostage. Of the thousands who took part in the violence in Jarawala, only 301 are facing trial. Most are out on bail, police records show. Christian town resident Anush Anthony says the people involved in the violence and arson returned home to cheers upon release and were welcomed as if they had done something great. Christian Action Committee member Shakil Bhatti says the officials who witnessed assured them of justice, but the situation is very disappointing. In July, an anti-terrorism court sentenced a Christian man to death. Authorities said his social media posts containing blasphemous content fanned the August 16 violence. As the community slowly gets back on its feet, fear persists. Resident Shehnaz Masih says she does not feel safe. There is no mental peace. Even if something happens somewhere else, they get scared, lock their doors, lose sleep. For now, in the streets of Christian town, the epicenter of last year's violence, an uneasy calm remains. Sara Zaman, VOA News, Jarawala, Punjab, Pakistan.
Dogs are known for their keen sense of smell. That's why they're used by police and military worldwide to seek out everything from drugs to guns and even money. At South Korea's Incheon International Airport, they're using a dog to seek out bed bugs from those returning from the Paris Olympics. Reuters correspondent Alice Rizzo has the story.
Last year, authorities in the French capital raced to contain a nationwide panic over bed bugs as it geared up for the Games. Sesco Pest Control Company researcher Kim Min-soo.
Our bedbug-sniffing dog, Seko, has a brain area for detecting the pheromone scent specific to bedbugs that is about 40 times larger than that of humans. So the accuracy in locating bedbugs based on their scent is over 95%.
Authorities deployed Seko on Friday at its main Incheon International Airport in a bid to reduce the risk of the tiny insects entering the country. He is the first and so far only canine trained in the country to detect the odor of pheromones, the chemicals released by bedbugs, Sesco said. The company teamed up with South Korea Ministries of Security and Transportation, as well as the Disease Control and Prevention Agency, to screen travelers on arrival. He will continue to work until September 8, the government said.
It can be sensitive for travelers to have someone open their suitcases. There used to be a process where people visually inspect items, which could be cumbersome. But our bedbug sniffer dog, Seko, can detect bedbugs with just about a third of the zipper on a suitcase opened by sniffing the air inside, which is a significant advantage.
Alongside the sniffer dog, South Korea is rolling out extra measures to keep bedbugs away. Flights arriving directly from Paris are being disinfected once a week instead of once a month. And if an outbreak is detected, the airport quarantine service is ready to swing into action. South Korea sent 144 athletes to the Olympics in Paris, which ended on Sunday. The country went through a period of its own national hysteria after reports of suspected infestations in 2023.
It conducted a widespread disinfection campaign.
Reuters correspondent Alice Rizzo. This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of everyone at VOA, thank you for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com. In Washington, I'm Alexis Strope.